That's where we've got to talk about radiculopathy versus radicular pain. So if somebody's got radiculopathy, then you don't expect to see reflex reduction. But it would be nice for us to also be able to pick people with radicular pain so that then we are able to try and prevent them going on to having a radiculopathy as well. So I think it is important that we can pick both of those people.
Diagnosing cervical radiculopathy can be tricky, and we want to distinguish it from everyday neck and shoulder pain. So today we had Julia Trelevan on, who she's a lecturer at the University of Queensland, and she's been doing research in this area since the year 2000. She's been involved in hundreds of publications. She's also published a book called The Management of Neck Disorders, an Evidence-Based Approach. Well, today we went over two papers specifically around the subjective history tips that will help us distinguish the diagnosis, and also the upper limb tension tests and how reliable and valid they were. A really helpful episode in the management of neck and shoulder pain. My name is Michael Risk, and this is Physio Explained. Welcome, Julia, and thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Now, you did two Physio Network research reviews on a couple of papers that we were going to cover today and dig a little bit deeper. Could you start by taking us through what they aimed to find in those two papers, what they did, and what the findings were? Maybe we start with the paper that spoke more about the interview and the subjective history.
So that one was conducted by a group from the Netherlands, and they tried to look at the diagnostic accuracy of patient interview items and clinical tests for cervical radiculopathy. So they had a neurosurgeon diagnose these patients based on clinical signs as well as confirmation on the MRI. And then they went ahead and asked patients about certain interview items. The interview items that they asked about, they came up with by looking at sort of like a focus group of a couple of physios and the neurosurgeon to sort of come up with the kind of questions that they asked. And then they did some clinical tests, which they got from the literature to see what they were going to use. And so basically they used tests of the Sperling's test. They used a test of lifting the arm above the head. They used active movements, muscle tests, an upper limb neurodynamic test, and the neurological examination. And so they basically found that if the patient reported that the arm pain was worse than the neck pain, or the symptoms were increased when they were ironing, which was an interesting finding, or reduced by walking with their hand in their pocket, and there was a positive Sperling's test, or presence of reduced reflexes, that there was an increased likelihood of cervical radiculopathy. They also found that if they didn't report paresthesia or numbness, there was less likelihood of these things. So that's basically what they found. They didn't actually put all of those things together. So they looked at each sort of individual item separately and looked at the sensitivity and specificity of those. But I think from a clinical perspective, you know, we can probably put those things together and use things like positive Sperling's tests, the reduced reflexes, along with the symptomatic complaints. And that might help us clinicians to try and identify people who have got more of a cervical radiculopathy.
It's really clear, clean research, which in a time where a lot of research is being quite grey, I was attracted to this because some really nice, almost pearls, and if you could cluster those things together, that would be really helpful. Could you talk to me, take me back to how did the neurosurgeons diagnose? Was it MRI or subjective or all of that?
So it was MRI and also patient reports. So if the patient was reporting, for example, the distribution in this, you know, C6, indicating that it was likely a C6, then they had to find findings on the MRI that were reflective of that on the same side and at that level for them to say that it was a radiculopathy.
So matching the interview up with the surgeon's opinion with an MRI.
Yes, all three things. Yeah, all three things had to happen. Yeah.
That's a solid cluster. And then is it a correlation or a likelihood ratio? Which was the strongest of those findings, and like how likely was it?
So they found that Arm pain, worse than neck pain, provocation of symptoms when ironing, and reduction of symptoms by walking with the hand in the pocket showed a high specificity, so about 81 to 85%. So that suggested that the presence of these items more likely suggested that the patient had radiculopathy, but they did have low sensitivity. So if they didn't have these things, that doesn't necessarily always indicate the patient didn't have radiculopathy. Whereas the presence of paresthesia and presence of numbness had, again, high sensitivity, so suggesting that when these are not present, it's less likely. But again, they had poor specificity, so the likelihood ratios of all of the patient interview items were sort of limited value in isolation. And then when you come to the clinical tests, the Sperling test was about 84%, reflexes at 81%, and they had the highest specificity, but the sensitivity of these were lower at around about 55, 57%. So I think it would be that they didn't do that in this paper, and that may have been because, you know, that wasn't one of the aims, but it would have been really nice to see if they could put them all together to see, you know, what was the thing that maybe came up with the best thing, or maybe that flushed things out. You know, maybe if they try to put things together, then it doesn't help. So, but it would have been interesting to see if they didn't say whether they did or didn't do that.
Yeah. I like it. It's also a really good review of your specificities and sensitivities. So when to rule things in and when you can't rule things out. Clinically, do you see this, Julia? I was just thinking biological plausibility of ironing or walking around with something heavy in your hand. That tends to make a lot of sense. What do you think of that finding?
Yeah, definitely. I think, you know, with the ironing, because it's got both upper limb and neck positioning, you know, so often people are in that flex position, but they're also using their upper limb. So it's sort of putting load on both areas. So I think that's probably why that one came out more than some of the other things which they asked about. And then definitely, I mean, we know that a lot of people with radiculopathy, you know, they present supporting their arm or, you know, putting their arm on their head. So that makes sense that those two items came out. So I think intuitively physios probably would even already know that, but it's nice to have it, you know, confirmed and that sort of thing.
It is, because it's almost something that like is an old wives' tale of physiotherapy is like, oh yeah, when someone walks with their hand in their pocket, it's almost something that could be carried on as a myth, but to see the research support that, I found that refreshing.
Yeah. I mean, again, it could also be, you know, people who've got some nerve mechanosensitivity might also do that as well. And so, again, you know, I think it would be really nice to look at these sort of features in people who've been diagnosed with some other differentials that we need to consider. That would be a really cool study as well. So these are nice studies because they're clinically relevant, they answer questions, and so I think they're really good.
And it pairs really well with the second article, which is the accuracy of the upper limb tension test. So take us to that. What was the outcome and what were they trying to find with that paper?
Yeah, it was interesting. When I got this one, I thought, oh, this must be from the same group, you know. But this was Francis Grondin, and he's based in France, and he also had like people like Chad Cook and Toby Hall on the paper as well. So in this study, they looked at four different neurodynamic tests to see whether any of these could be used to diagnose focal radiculopathy. And they really tried very hard to use a very strict criteria for a positive test. And I think that's really important as physios that, you know, we do make sure that we do that. So for it to be a positive test, they had to report similar or familiar reproduction of their symptoms. Plus, they also had to have that change with structural differentiation, using known sensitizing maneuvers. So that meant that, you know, if you increase the neurodynamic stretch, that you would increase those symptoms, and if you decreased it, then you decreased it. So that was their thing. So then they did the upper limb the median nerve, upper limb neurodynamic test 1 and 2, radial nerve 2B, and the ulnar nerve. So they did all four. And they found that essentially if all of them were negative, then you can pretty much rule out cervical radiculopathy with about 96% certainty. So that's pretty good. The other thing, though, was that three out of four tests ruled it in with pretty good certainty, so 86% certainty, but only 12 out of the 27 people who had radiculopathy had three out of four tests positive. So that means that, you know, you might miss some people if you're just going for those three positive tests. But I think, you know, good if you do all those neurodynamic tests and they're all negative, then pretty high chance that they haven't got radiculopathy. One thing I did think with this study, you know, very well done and great, but they had to do the test 5 minutes apart to make sure that they didn't stir anybody up. And most of these people were, particularly in both studies, they were chronic. So they were, you know, at least 6 months down the track. So I don't know about you, but the kind of people that I see in clinic are the really acute ones.
Yep.
And you're probably not going to be able to do any of those, or very many of those tests on those people. So I'm not sure if this one clinically, probably good for somebody in more that chronic subacute stage. In the acute stage, it probably would be better to use the previous study from a clinical perspective. But I think it's handy to know that, you know, if you do these neurodynamic tests and they're all negative, then you can pretty much say they don't have spike or radiculopathy.
You're touching on some really wonderful clinical pearls of this was in a more subacute to persistent chronic population. The first batch papered would, you can't get that far in someone who's this acute with the upper limb tension test, so you'd lean more on the subjective history. I wanted to touch on something you mentioned here. It needed to reproduce their symptoms. I think that's a key when we're talking about a shift away from all of these special tests not being that accurate. I think that's a beautiful way to bring some accuracy back to it. Is it matching up with the patient's presentation plus the clinical tests? That stood out to me. Julia, what I'm imagining is a beautiful CPD session where all the health professionals would listen to this podcast, review the four upper limb tension tests and review some of those subjective histories and practice all of this.
Mm.
What would be your kind of two or three pearls from this paper that health professionals could take into the clinic?
I think, you know, asking specifically about the activities that aggravate or decrease their pain. Obviously, you know, they use those certain things like ironing, but, you know, I think even if it's just using the upper limb while they're in a position with their neck as well, doing the Sperling's test. And again, we didn't talk about that as well, but, you know, that's also been shown to be known to be a little bit provocative as well. And a lot of people wouldn't want to do a Sperling's, but they did it very carefully. And if they got any symptoms, even on that first part, then they stopped.
Yeah.
So I think that's important. And, you know, they did do a distraction test, which, you know, you sort of think, okay, well, positive Sperling's, but, you know, would they have also had decreased pain if you did a distraction? But that test didn't come out as well as the Sperling's test. So I think using the patient reports, obviously the reflexes is important as well. That's where we've got to talk about radiculopathy versus radicular pain. So if somebody's got radiculopathy, then you don't expect to see reflex reduction. But it would be nice for us to also be able to pick people with radicular pain so that then we are able to try and prevent them going on to having a radiculopathy as well. So I think it is important that we can pick both of those people. So, yeah, so I think probably patient reports along with the reflexes or the positive Sperling and then a positive neurodynamic test if you're able to do it.
Yeah, I love that. So two wonderful papers to sit down with and review, probably reviewing your subjective history, the questions you ask or little asterisks that you're looking for, and making sure you're across specificities, sensitivities, and the four upper limb tension tests they've mentioned in the paper. Julia, thank you so much for your time and your clinical opinions attached to this. We're going to put these two papers and your research review in the show notes as well, but I just wanted to thank you for bringing that real clinical edge to these two papers.
Thanks very much, and thanks for having me.